Please be seated. Good afternoon. We will have our final case for today, and it is 02-1384 National Auto Truck Stops, Inc. v. Wisconsin Department of Transportation. Bradley Gunn representing National Auto Truck Stops. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Diane Girth, and I am an attorney licensed to practice in the state of Wisconsin, and I am here to formally introduce Bradley Gunn, my colleague. Mr. Gunn has been admitted pro hoc vici in this matter and will be presenting the case on behalf of our clients, National Auto Truck Stops.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the Court, counsel, my name is Brad Gunn, and together with Ms. Girth, we do represent National Auto Truck Stops, Incorporated. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to appear here today to discuss the two issues that are before the Court. These are issues that are near and dear to my heart, and I also believe they have considerable importance to property owners throughout the state of Wisconsin. The first of these issues involves the question of whether a property owner is entitled to compensation for the loss of existing access when his or her property is involved in a condemnation case. And with respect to that issue, I will ask the Court to apply existing Wisconsin law. The second issue that we're dealing with this afternoon has to do with the admissibility of the income approach to valuation. And on that issue, I'm going to ask you to stretch a bit and to reconsider and, frankly, to reverse or modify your previous precedents on this subject, or alternatively, at the least, to at least find that the facts of this case fall within the various exceptions set forth in your previous decisions. I'll spend just a short moment on the facts of the case. National Auto Truck Stops is also known as TA, or Travel Centers of America. It's the owner of the largest chain of truck stops in the country, with something over 150 locations nationwide. The term truck stop is itself probably an anachronism today. What we think of as truck stops can no longer cater to or depend on simply truck traffic. Instead, they are dependent on and rely upon automobile traffic. TA is the owner of what is known as Twin City East Travel Center, which is located in Hudson. The property, the land, the buildings, the real estate is owned by TA, and it is leased to a separate entity known as Twin City East Travel Center. The property is located in the northeast quadrant of Highway 12 and I-94, a couple miles outside of Hudson. With the Court's permission, could I refer to a trial exhibit that I've enlarged today to point out the location of the property and its orientation?
Is it part of the record, counsel?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Okay. Ms. McGee, do you have any objection?
Well, to the extent that it is a part of the record, there are smaller copies of it in the record, but I won't object since it was admitted as an exhibit at trial.
Thank you. Counsel. So, You're being taped, and unless we put a microphone on you, you won't readily be taped. You will be heard. You have been heard.
Thank you.
This is you're showing us an exhibit that depicts the travel center before the taking.
And in that before situation, cars are in the travel center from this driveway, with the access, I'm supposed to gas on the convenience store, the restaurant, wherever they wish. Trucks would enter through a separate driveway that's located just off the map up in this corner. They would come down, fuel, turn around, and then exit through that same driveway. You can see there's a divide here to keep the truck traffic separate from the automobile traffic.
Now, that's how far from I-94?
This is literally the exit ramp from I-94 coming up, so you would be approximately right here in the scale. Now, in the mid-1990s, the state decided to upgrade this intersection, and as part of that project, the state closed this driveway opening. Well, the truck driveway opening and condemned the northwest corner, relatively small piece of TA's property, constructed a new frontage road, new road to the north called Brockton Road, and then a frontage road which came ran south to join up the property. Now, the first issue in this case has to do with the question of whether the loss of TA's access is compensable in a partial taking case like this. Now, since it's a partial taking case, it is governed by Wisconsin Statute Section 3209, parenthesis 6.
That's Counsel, if I may just for a moment interrupt, that's your before picture. Now, the after picture, as I understand the facts, and as I tried to diagram them earlier today, created a frontage road. There was only one access to the frontage road, but then the two different accesses for the cars and trucks remained somewhat the same?
It's a little more confusing than that.
You have a picture of the after?
There is one appended to the state's brief toward the back. It's black and white, and it's not the easiest thing in the world to read.
But maybe you can just tell me with that picture, where are the present access for the trucks and the cars now? Where are they located now?
I'm glad that is
dead. You're doing fine.
I didn't mean my.
Okay.
To access the property now, after the taking, you would go north on Highway 12, up past the first old driveway, the second driveway, which has now been removed, up north to a new road called Brockie Road.
That's about 700 feet north of where that truck access was, 697 feet.
That sounds correct.
Okay.
Yes. You'd then proceed east on Brockie Road, 100 feet perhaps, I'm sorry I can't be more precise off the top of my head, then turn south onto the new frontage road and proceed, again, a matter of several hundred feet down to the property. Both trucks and cars would use that new frontage road to access the property.
And then where does it come in now?
It's up in the northwest corner.
As I understand it, there's two different accesses, one for trucks and one for cars, even now.
There's one access point for trucks and cars.
One access to the frontage road.
Correct.
But from the frontage road to the truck stop, as I understand it, there's two.
No, that's incorrect.
Okay.
From Brockie Road, there is the new road that goes east-west.
Mm-hmm.
There is another driveway that connects to the truck stop. And when trucks exit, they're instructed to go out the eastern exit on the northeast part of the property and then follow Brockie back to Highway 12.
And where do cars come in and out?
At the same place. They come in at the same place the trucks come in the northwest corner. They drive down the frontage road, access the property, and then go back out the way they came in.
Well, there are then one particular entrance into that park for trucks and one for cars.
It's the same entrance for both trucks.
Well, it's the same entrance in terms of getting off these streets or highways. But when you get off, the trucks get off, as I understand it, in the upper part, and then the cars come in the lower part. No?
I think I understand now.
Okay.
Both trucks and cars follow the frontage road until they reach the property's boundaries, approximately.
Right.
And the frontage road continues further south. Trucks would get off further north.
Right.
Cars would continue further south on the frontage road to this
There's
point.
A separation of trucks and cars on entering this unit. Never mind. Just go ahead.
Well, it's an incomplete separation. There is, when you get further south, they're commingled further north, though.
Okay. So why do we care about all of this?
Because it's directly relevant to the ultimate question of whether a property owner is entitled to compensation for the interference with their access.
They still have access. It's just different, right?
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Still have to leave I-90 to get to your client's premises.
Correct.
They did before. They do now. They just take a little longer route.
That is correct.
And they can't get off of 12 now. They have to go up around.
There's no longer direct access to Highway 12.
Right.
But, yes, they can get from Highway 12 to the property via Brocky Road and then the frontage road.
Right.
Correct.
Which is the change from as it was before, which is from this diagram.
Precisely.
Exhibit.
Well, is it accurate to say that cars traveling north on Highway 12, or cars or trucks, have to go approximately 2 football fields farther than they did before to get onto the frontage road, but cars traveling north to south on Highway 12 actually get off to the frontage road a little bit sooner than they used to?
Yes, a little more.
We're talking about 697 feet at most.
It's a little bit more than that for cars, and then that's not counting the distance they have to travel back to the property.
Well, is there any evidence that would indicate that this interfered with the amount of traffic into the truck stop or anything like that? Because at least as the Court of Appeals said, there's no taking here because the access, you still got access. And it's apparently, nobody disputes that it's not reasonable access.
Your Honor, we do dispute that it's not reasonable access or dispute that it might be reasonable access. The Court of Appeals assumed that it was reasonable access, but in fact, that was a subject we were never even permitted to introduce testimony on because of the trial court's decision on the motion in limine. Now, the question of what's reasonable access is a question of fact under all of the decisions of this court. And while this court hasn't specifically addressed it, the other courts that have say what constitutes reasonable access is dependent in part on the use to which the property is put. Now, if this is a single-family home and you have to drive a few extra football fields to get there, it's not going to matter. You know, that would still be reasonable access. The reality is that for a property like this that's heavily dependent on impulse transactions by buyers who want to get off the freeway, they want to go in and fill up on gas as quick as they can, stop at the convenience store, and there's a reason they call it a convenience store, that is critical to the success of a property like this, that kind of direct, quick, immediate access.
Well, can you tell that from the I-90 system? I mean, I go off on I-90, and it says gas, and I'm not sure whether that's 10 miles or half a mile and whether the access is going to be readily available or I'm going to have to circle around a lot of stores and lose my way.
And the reality is, Your Honor, you care about that. It makes a difference to you
but
as it does
to... But I don't know from I-90. I just take my chances. Can you see from I-90 whether this is easy access or difficult access?
No, you couldn't. You'd have to get off on Highway 12, which actually is the road on which National Auto abutted, and it's the road that I respectfully submit the court's inquiry should be focused on, rather than I-94.
Just one other question that we're asking on the facts, and I guess, are there other truck stops on this? Are there other truck stops right here? That other competitor truck stops right at this intersection or where you get off of I-94?
There are no other truck stops at this intersection. There is a gas station to the north of TA's property.
But just for clarification, is this on the north side of the interstate or the south side?
It's on the north side, the northeast quadrant.
So if you didn't turn on that off-ramp, you'd end up eventually in Minnesota?
You would.
Now I got you. All right.
Which...
That's an incentive to turn up. No, no.
You'd be good. You're in the case.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Your Honor, the state has cited, and we have cited, about 10 or 12 different cases as being controlling on the access issues in this case. When you first start reading those cases, at least to me, they seem to be a little bit all over the map. When you spend a little more time with them, it turns out they can all be reconciled, and it's really not that difficult to reconcile them. It comes down to two factors, and those two factors alone have been dispositive of the property owner's entitlement to compensation in every single case that this court has decided and that we have cited to you. Those two factors are, has there been a partial taking of the owner's property, and does the action or the project involve a controlled access or a limited access highway? In this case, it's a partial taking. It's not a controlled access highway.
Partial take, don't you have to be more precise than that, counsel? Because you're talking about a partial taking of access.
No, I'm also talking about a partial taking of property, you know.
Well, that permanent 0.27 acres, the 0.27 acres was taken. I don't think anybody disputes that.
Correct.
But it seems to me that you are, at least the Court of Appeals said, that you misunderstand your rights of access under the taking, that in fact you don't have any particular right to a particular point of access, of ingress and egress, so long as you have ingress and egress. And that was not taken from you because it's still here. It's still there. Cars and trucks can still get to your truck stop.
Again, I'm going to harken back to my point that if you take a look at the 10 or 12 cases that we cite, two of those involve precisely, you know, the situation where, I'm going to backtrack and I apologize. Looking at the cases as a whole, the only two things that have ever mattered to this court have been whether it's a partial taking and whether it's a controlled access highway. There are five decisions that have involved those two situations: the Crown case, Narlock, Hastings, Carazella, and Bear. And in each of those cases, this court held that the owner was entitled to compensation for the impairment of access.
But Schneider, how do you deal with Schneider, where it held that deprivation of direct access does not constitute a taking of property provided reasonable access remains? That cites McKenna.
Schneider falls into the same category as do the second Carazella decision and the Surety case. Both of those involved a partial taking, but they were controlled access highways. And in those cases, this court said the property owner is not entitled to compensation because the state, through a proper exercise of its police power, had already declared the road to be controlled access. So you got five cases where it wasn't a controlled access. The property owner recovered in all five of those. You got three where it wasn't. The property owner didn't recover because in those cases, the state had exercised its police power. You didn't do that in this case.
The I-90 system is a controlled access, right?
Yes.
And wasn't this designed to assist the I-90 system?
The property itself and Highway 12 predated I-94.
I understand that, but the taking here was designed as to help rebuild the I-90 system and the exit, right?
That is correct.
So why isn't this part of the controlled access highway system?
Again, Your Honor, if I may, National Auto abutted on, under Wisconsin law, property owners whose land abuts on a public highway have a right of access to that highway.
Right. That's 12. Highway 12.
Precisely. We never had, ever since I-94 was established, any right of direct access to I-94. So the state can do whatever it wants to there, and we have no right to complain. The situation is different with respect to Highway 12, because that is a road that we did abut on. It's a road that we had direct access to, and it was not a controlled access highway. So that's why I'm, again, requesting that we, you know, focus our attention on the situation with respect to Highway 12 and not 94.
Was there any evidence put into this record with respect to the reasonableness of the access?
We were not allowed to put any evidence into the record with respect to the reasonableness of the access. The trial court ruled as a matter of law that the access was not, or that the interference with access was not compensable because he said, you know, the trial court, that as a matter of law, the state has the right to control access through its police power. Therefore, the state could have chosen to eliminate access here, presumably, he wasn't specific, but presumably by declaring the highway a controlled access highway. So since they could have eliminated access that way, they didn't have to pay for diminishing it in this case. And the problem with that argument is that it was specifically rejected in Carrizella, in Hastings, in Crown. In all of those cases, typically the government or the party who is sitting in the place of the government made that exact same argument that, gee, we could have eliminated your access through an exercise of our police power. Therefore, we shouldn't have to pay for taking it in the context of a condemnation case. And in every one of those cases, the court held differently and said, because this is a partial taking case, which, you know, triggers a fundamental constitutional protection, the right to just compensation when private property is taken, it falls under a different heading, and the owner is entitled to compensation.
Counsel, I notice you're running out of time. And it seems that there's some confusion as to our holding in Vivid and Leatham, and that maybe you want to address that second issue. I don't mean to cut off any, with all respect, any members of the court, but I just noticed your yellow light is on. And
I noticed the same thing, Your Honor. I'll get to that almost immediately. I do want to make one additional point on the access question. There were several questions about the fact, and the Court of Appeals raised it, that, gee, the property still had reasonable access after the taking. Shouldn't that be sufficient? We shouldn't have to pay for it. The only time that this Court has discussed the concept of reasonable access, I shouldn't say only, the only one that I've run across in all the cases we cited, was in the context of controlled access highways. And there the Court said, under its police power, you can limit, you can restrict access to a property, but if you deprive it of all access, then that's a taking, even though it's a controlled access highway. That's not the situation here. This was not a controlled access case. In the Bear case, in the Narlock case, the property owner still had direct access. Those were partial takings. They were not controlled access highways. And the property owner retained driveways to the old road. We don't even have that. We've got this circuitous thing that loops all around and would dissuade anyone from coming there. In contrast, in Bear and Narlock, the owner retained direct access. The court said it doesn't matter that they still had direct access. This is a partial taking, so the property owner is entitled to compensation.
Mr. Gunn, should you prevail, what do you expect this court to do? Remand it to the trial court, let you put in evidence of whether the access is reasonable, let you put in evidence on your income in terms of compensation for this taking of access? I mean, what do you want the court to do?
Remand on the access question and hold as a matter of law that in a partial taking case that involves a non-controlled access highway, the property owner is entitled to compensation for the diminution or the whatever interference with access he or she has suffered because of the project.
Well, there has to be unreasonable diminution.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor.
Oh, you disagree. That's why I'm asking you. So any diminution?
Any diminution. That's correct. In the alternative, as we have set forth in the briefs, if the court believes that the question of reasonable access is relevant, and I don't think that under your earlier decisions it is, then at least that's a factual question, and it should be presented to the jury on a remand.
Okay. All right.
With respect to the income approach issue, yes, we believe that not only we, but any property owner, as well as the state, should be permitted to introduce evidence as to the income approach to valuation of any commercial property.
Okay, now that goes to the 0.27 acres as well as the access issue? Do you want to send that back to
the
valuation of the 0.27?
It's part and parcel of the whole thing. In a partial taking condemnation, damages are measured between the difference between the market value of the property before and the market value of the property after the taking. So we could introduce, if we were to prevail, evidence as to the value of the property under the income approach, as well as the other approaches, both with respect to the value before and after.
You want us to reverse the court of appeals?
Yes, Your Honor.
In total, and then the jury can come back with less than they gave you originally, or more?
Theoretically, they could come back with less. I think that's, frankly, very unlikely.
Well, counsel, for years, obviously, we've had a rule. The fair market value is best established by determining what a reasonable buyer would pay a reasonable seller. And therefore, comparable sales have always been the touchstone. Now, I understand there are a number of comparable sales here. Am I wrong on that?
There are no other truck stops within X number of miles. There are comparable land sales. We went out of state to find other truck stop sales. But, I mean, frankly, your point, Your Honor, is a good one, but I think it needs to go to the next level, which is that willing buyer, willing seller, willing buyers and willing sellers of commercial properties are interested more than anything else in what kind of a return am I going to get on this property? And the return that they're going to get is net income, which is capitalized, and in the real world, that tells them how much they will pay for the property. That's how it works in the real world.
On the income capitalization, is that the income from rental?
Precisely.
And the rent will vary depending upon how much business they can do, which you say will vary upon access. Is that your point?
No, that is not my point. The rent will not vary depending on how much business they can do. If you own a property and you lease it to somebody who opens a restaurant, if they have the best food in town and it's the most superbly run place in town, they're going to do very well. But you're going to continue to receive the same market rents that you negotiated as part of your lease.
Not when that lease is up. I'm going to ask for more.
That is true. But during the pendency of the lease. Further, the appraiser doesn't just look at, in fact, technically isn't even supposed to look at, how the specific property being evaluated is doing. They determine market rents the same way as they determine comparable sales. They go out into the marketplace and they find commercial buildings that are leased for similar purposes in similar locations with similar access, and they say, how much do these properties lease for? And that's what they use to determine their market rents. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gunn. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. McGee, Assistant Attorney General representing the State of Wisconsin Department of Transportation.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. As you have indicated, I am Assistant Attorney General Pamela McGee, appearing this afternoon in behalf of the Department of Transportation. As you have noted, two issues have been put before this court for review today, the access issue and whether or not the income approach, whether or not Latham Smith should be overruled and the income approach should be allowed. With respect to the access issue, before I forget, I'd like to respond to a question that was posed to counsel regarding whether or not the opportunity was ever given to put in evidence as to whether or not the alternative access was reasonable. I did not represent the state at that point in time, although I did represent the state below. And it's my understanding that there was never a request for an evidentiary hearing. There was never actually a challenge to the reasonableness, whether or not.
Did the trial court essentially take judicial notice so that what was the after picture was still reasonable, or how did he do this as a matter of law?
Well, I only have his opinion to rely on because As I said, I came in after that opinion had been rendered. But in this particular situation, we have a frontage road, which, as I would like to make the points regarding the applicability of the interstate highway statute, specifically indicates that a frontage road is per se reasonable access when the change has been made in furtherance of the interstate highway system. I'm not positive what his thinking was on that. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, you can finish. My question goes to the controlled and uncontrolled access argument that opposing counsel is making relative to the five cases and the three cases. Are you satisfied that this is a uncontrolled access?
No, Your Honor. I'm satisfied that this particular highway, that there was never a proceeding under the controlled access statute, in other words, to actually designate it as a controlled access highway pursuant to the statute that applies. However, I do believe that it is controlled in the to the extent that there is the police power has been extended to the department, first of all, by reason of the fact that this upgrade and change was part of an upgrade and change to the interstate system itself there at that interchange where the I-94 and Highway 12 meet. The court was kind enough to take judicial notice of some additional documents that I provided to the court prior to this, at the time I filed my brief, and that was a design study that specifically showed that the entire process was part of the upgrade of the interchange and for a certain distance on either side of that interchange was a part of the interstate project. And
let me just ask that.
Yes.
Because the argument is, looking at this exhibit, is that initially the uncontrolled was uncontrolled off of 12. So it was, at least before there was the alleged taking, that it was uncontrolled. But you're saying because it's part of the I system that it really is a controlled situation.
That is one of the reasons that I am indicating that our position is that because it is part of the interstate system and the project was undertaken pursuant to that, the removal of the access was pursuant to police power.
Are you arguing that the access before the taking was controlled or uncontrolled?
Well, that goes to a second issue that I'm not sure that I emphasized significantly enough in my brief, and I wanted to bring it to the court's attention today. Even if this were not a interstate project and part of the interstate project with federal funding and with the design including the entire area and all the reasons for relocating the access having to do with the reasons for which there aren't accesses directly onto an interstate. In this situation, prior to this project, there was a driveway permit for the northerly access, and that had been issued pursuant to the police power of the department under 8607. And there is a copy of that permit in the appraisal, in the record, in the state's appraisal. And the back of that permit sets limitations on what can be done and the power that the state continues to have with respect to control of whether this access continues to exist. Now, that permit went to the northerly access. And therefore, we certainly take the position that the state had the power pursuant to 8607 and thereby police power to relocate the access. Unfortunately, we have not been able to locate a permit for the southerly access, but we have to assume that under the circumstances, one probably existed, and it probably had the same restrictions on it and the same opportunities for the state to effect access one way or another as are set forth in the permit that is part of the record. However, even if that were not the case, the statutes require that in order to have an access onto a state trunk highway, the owner has to apply for a permit. So if there were no permit, then this would be an illegal access.
In your brief, you state that the Department of Transportation was authorized that this is an interstate highway project. This is on page 6 of your brief. And you say, therefore, DOT was authorized pursuant to 8429 to change access points without providing compensation to National Auto. Now, what is your support for that phrase, without providing compensation to National Auto? Where do you get that out of the statute?
If it is an interstate project, under 8429, the state can, there's an alternative choice. The state can either pay compensation for relocating the access or provide a frontage road. And indeed,
that's in 8429?
Yes.
Do you know what subsection of 8429?
Well, I can find it in just one second here.
That's subsection 4, maybe?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm going to have to see if I can find my copy of the statute here. 8429. Yes. Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
What, subsection 4?
Yes.
Could you read the part of the statute that you say provides that?
It says that access to abutting property shall be provided by means of frontage roads as a part of the interstate highway development or the right of access to or crossing of the public highway shall be acquired on behalf of the state as part of the interstate. In other words, acquired by...
That's in subsection 4, huh?
Yes. Hmm. Right above subsection 5. The couple sentences right above subsection 5. May I continue? Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry, I'm just very slow, I guess, this afternoon. What does that have to do with your statement, your conclusion, that therefore they don't have to pay any compensation?
Well, the point is there reasonable alternative access? And the reasonable alternative access is stated in this subsection as being per se reasonable alternative access.
Any access is per se reasonable? Is that what you're saying?
Not necessarily. This specifically refers to a frontage road, the provision of a frontage road, and that therefore it is per se reasonable. And I think the fact, in returning to my driveway permit argument, both of those arguments indicate that there are other situations beyond a controlled access situation where the state can effect access pursuant to its police power. It can do it pursuant to the Interstate Highway Authority statute. It can do it pursuant to the statute that gives it the power to regulate by permit. And I think that is reflected, that the state understood that that's what it was doing in this case by reason of the fact that it did not actually include payment for the relocation of the accesses in its award of damages, and understood that it indeed was going according to its police power. And certainly, I think that the claim that the plaintiff has made here, that the only time the state can exercise its police power in affecting access is when it is a controlled access highway. I think the two statutes that I've discussed.
Ms. McGee, would you stand in front
of me? Oh, sorry.
Are you essentially arguing that this was a de facto police power taking?
No, I'm arguing that these statutes that I've cited and...
Except you didn't invoke any of those statutes, as I understand it. But this project? You didn't proceed under any of those statutes with this project.
Well, that's what I'm saying. The award of damages did not include any compensation for these accesses, and therefore it appears that the state was proceeding pursuant to that. There is no proceeding that has to take place in order to say we're taking this because we have the power to do it under 8429 without compensation, or we have the power to do it under 8607. Those statutes stand for themselves and provide the state with the authority and to affect the access without compensation.
On page 6, you say the facts show that the project resulted in a change of access was an interstate highway project. How do we know that? Just because it affected interstate highway? Did you get federal funds for the interstate highway? Did you meet federal requirements for an interstate highway project?
That is why I requested that the design study, that you take notice of the design study, because that
said... You granted that motion.
Yes, you did. And that study reflects that that it was all part of one project, first of all, and that it was done for the reasons that any direct access to an interstate highway would have been done for, and also that it was 90% federal funding, it set forth in that document. So, yes, there are a number of reasons to conclude that the department was proceeding under the understanding that it was working according to the rules affecting the interstate highway system, right down to the fact that a frontage road was provided as a relocated access. And, of course, that frontage road is part of, is not owned by the plaintiff. It's owned by, originally, I guess, the state, but by a governmental authority. And so the access, indeed, really is still in the same places as it was prior to the time that the original accesses were relocated, insofar as their relationship to a state highway is concerned.
But could I ask a question, just a very simple explanation? Just compensation appears to be different depending on whether you're dealing with controlled access or uncontrolled access. Is that right?
Well, I think the point is of the cases as they presently exist does not necessarily... I think my argument with respect to the two statutes that establish the authority of the department to affect access are not inconsistent with the way the plaintiff has described the present existence of some of the case law, and that in those cases, the ones where compensation was not necessary, indeed there were controlled access highways. There had been that process that the department had to go through in order to determine that this would be a controlled access highway. And in those cases where the department was required to pay compensation, indeed those highways had not been designated as controlled access highways.
But what I'm trying to get at is the Constitution doesn't change. The nature of the highway changes. So why does the compensation change depending on the nature of the highway?
Well, I think that it has been determined that the public welfare and safety are significant enough that the state can exercise its police power in effecting accesses based on determinations as to whether or not otherwise the safety and care of the motoring public is going to be implicated, which is pretty much the justification, for example, for not allowing any accesses or closing accesses, whatever, onto the various interstate highways.
So it's a different power that's being used?
The police power is being used in behalf of the safety and regulation of the accesses. Excuse me.
What you're saying, if I'm hearing you right, is the police power means that you can regulate access to Highway 12 for public safety. It won't be a taking unless it's unreasonable access. If you take the view that it's not a controlled highway, if you take the view that it is a controlled highway, you can regulate access, and here the statute says a frontage road is by law reasonable.
Well, I don't want to leave the impression that using the term controlled access, you would be talking about control of the access under various statutes, as opposed to the actual controlled roadway access, where you have to actually declare that it's a controlled roadway. But yes, that would basically.
Well, 12 is not a declared limited.
No, it is not. But I still would like to make the point that the other two statutes under that are, in our view, controlling here, give police power to the state to effect access and thereby, indeed, control the access.
What are those two statutes?
Those statutes aren't controlling. If you're referring to 8425 and 8429, those statutes have nothing to do with what went on here, as I read the case. This was a 3209 eminent domain proceeding, correct?
The acquisition of the small triangle of property was indeed what caused the issue relating to compensation to be able to be brought to the court.
Right, and you have invoked 8429 sub 4, which pertains to laying new interstate highways on existing state highways, which has nothing to do with what was going on here. And you've also invoked 8425 sub 1, which pertains to the police power on controlled access highways, which Highway 12 was not.
No, I'm not relying on 8425. I'm not claiming that Highway 12 was a controlled access highway pursuant to that statute. On the other hand, I am taking the position that 8429 does apply, and I would like to point out that sub 7 of 8429 clearly states that all the provisions of that section of the statutes are supposed to be determined and looked at favorably so that all of the objectives of that statute and the effort to maintain the interstate highway system can be achieved. And therefore, our position is that the entire statute and subsections do apply in this situation because we are pursuing the project under the interstate, improvement of the interstate interchange.
Which part of 8429 applies pursuant to that liberal construction that you're...
Well, I think partially what you just read. We are expanding the reach of the interchange system such that the Highway 12 is being expanded into four lanes. All of Highway 12 is being raised along with the bridge because the bridge was too low and various trucks, it wasn't accommodating trucks to be able to get under there. The safety problems with coming around off the access there and trying to turn immediately into the truck stop with large numbers of trucks backed up all the way down the interstate highway was a huge safety problem. And so for all those reasons, it was definitely concerns and considerations relating to the interstate highway
Was the interstate being relocated onto Highway 12?
I'm saying that the interstate was expanded. The interchange itself was expanded as part of the interstate highway system.
Okay. The statutory subsection that you've cited says an interstate highway may be established, laid out, and constructed as an expressway or freeway on and along an existing public highway. That's not what happened here.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree that that is indeed what happened here. But I also point out that the permit situation with respect to the driveways is applicable as an alternative argument with respect to whether or not the state could pursue its police power.
Speaking of alternative arguments, the Court of Appeals opinion was measure of simplicity itself. I don't understand why you're not arguing that. the Court of Appeals position. Are they wrong in what they said, and it's on page 5 of their opinion. The state has not taken National Auto's right of access because it has not completely removed its right of ingress and egress. National Auto still has access to Highway 12 through the frontage road, and a frontage road provides reasonable access to and from a landowner's property, citing Schneider. I mean, that seems simplicity itself.
I agree, Your Honor.
You agree it's simplicity, but do you agree with it? I don't see anywhere in their opinion where they cited 8429.
Well, that's true. They did not. And as I freely admit, that argument was not brought to the attention of the Court of Appeals. And if it had, I'm not sure what they would have done with it. Nor do I think the permit argument was fully expanded in the way that I should have expanded it before the Court of Appeals. But as far as actually relying on the Court of Appeals opinion, to the extent that this Court would believe that it is appropriate in light of prior case law, I certainly would not disagree with that, Your Honor.
How can the Court of Appeals decide it's reasonable access when there was no evidence of reasonableness?
Well, I guess they looked at the fact that it was a frontage road. I'm not positive about how that could be done, but I assume that they looked at the fact that there was a frontage road provided. The accesses off that frontage road are exactly the same locations as they were off of Highway 12, and because there hadn't been any challenge below as far as evidentiary a request for an evidentiary hearing on the reasonableness, I guess they must have taken it that there was no question there.
Attic law was reasonable.
The evidence was excluded. The circuit court simply didn't address that.
That's true, but it could have had the opportunity to do so if they had been requested to do so, and my understanding is that there was no request.
After the evidentiary ruling excluding this whole line of inquiry?
No, prior to the evidentiary ruling.
Counsel, that portion of the Court of Appeals opinion makes reference to it, this being a frontage road, then cites to the Schneider case. And I don't have the Schneider case in front of me. Perhaps you do or don't.
I do.
But does the Schneider case refer to 8429 sub 4, I guess it was, that you were talking about earlier in terms of it being a per se reasonable, that is, access via a frontage road, and you cited 8429, I thought, sub 4, the couple of sentences above sub 5 in response to Justice Babbage. If you don't know the answer, I can read Schneider also. I just
well,
didn't
actually,
have
to.
Would you stand?
Would
you please stand in front of the microphone? I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. What was your response?
My response was, I'm not sure it was pursuant to that statute, but I do believe it did cite, conclude that a frontage road was per se reasonable.
Schneider did?
Yes.
So there was a frontage road involved in Schneider?
Yep. Your Honor, I don't want to say something that's incorrect without rereading this case, which I've read a number of times in the last number of years, but unfortunately I can't remember exactly if this is the one. There is a case that does cite that, and I believe that's it.
To clarify the facts here, is the frontage road actually a frontage road to Highway 12 or a frontage road to Brocky Road? I'm having a little trouble reading the diagram that's in your appendix.
The frontage road, as I recall, is to Brocky Road, and then Brocky goes out. But I'm not positive about that.
So it's really not a frontage road to Highway 12 where the pre-existing access.
I wouldn't want to. I can't remember exactly. Let me just look at the back of my.
Kind of important, isn't it? The right of access that's in dispute is the right of access to Highway 12. And if this is a frontage road once removed, then it's going to be hard to argue that it's reasonable.
I believe that the frontage road starts at Highway 12, Your Honor, but I'd be happy to provide a site directly to the record that I don't have right now to that will reflect that.
I thought I understood that you had to turn off of Highway 12 onto Brocky and then turn off of Brocky onto the frontage road and then turn into the property. Is that not right?
I think it's just like one big turn. And if you're going to go down Brocky, you keep going. And if you're going to go into the truck stop, you turn into it that way.
Is the incomes approach
yes.
is in this case. Now, forgive me for being so simplistic, but as a tax appeals commissioner a number
yes.
of years ago, I'm quite sure that we often used the incomes approach in determining the valuation of commercial and manufacturing property. Is the theory in tax case different from the theory in eminent domain, making it less desirable or less proper to use an income approach in eminent domain?
Well, there are very specific statutes relating to how to determine fair compensation with relation to eminent domain cases. And as this Court has very specifically said, the income approach is never admissible when there are evidence of comparable sales. And that particular holding is very clear from this Court, and therefore, and for very good reasons, which are certainly have been discussed by this Court and by the lower courts in several recent cases as to why it is an entirely appropriate rule. And I think based on the fact that it's specific with respect to the rules relating to compensation under 32, it is specific as to those rules, Your Honor. And as a matter of fact, I would like to go on, and if I have just a moment here, to discuss that issue. Of course, the plaintiff has asked that this Court overrule Leatham Smith. And I would have to say that I see no reason whatsoever to do that because the comparable sales approach has stood the eminent domain process and the people of the state of Wisconsin in good stead. And the Court has indicated on many occasions that there is a great deal of difficulty with using the income approach. It's speculative. It requires taking into account future earnings based on who knows what type of interest rates and those kinds of things. Yes?
I'm not quite sure what the Leatham holding is or how valid it is, and I'm not sure what the rule of law is right now. And it seems to me there's you could say that the rule of law is that so long as there are comparable sales, the income approach cannot be used. That's the black letter rule. A subtle shade of that, however, is so long as there are comparable sales, the income approach is looked upon with disfavor. In other words, it doesn't quite throw it out all the way, but it's looked upon with disfavor. What do you think the rule of law is today?
I think the rule of law is that where there are comparable sales available, the income approach is never admissible, and I think
never. Okay, so it's not the disfavor. I think that's what the Court of Appeals said, right? The Court of Appeals said that essentially. I think they took the second route. It said they are looked upon with disfavor.
I think they just mentioned both.
Did they?
Both. Statements, just to indicate that this is the situation with the law here in the state of Wisconsin. Income approach is never admissible when there are comparable sales.
Well, on page 8 of the Court of Appeals opinion at the bottom, they do say, after they tried to reconcile Radiman and Leatham and Vivid, they say, nonetheless, Leatham, Vivid, and Radiman all stand for the proposition that income evidence is generally disfavored as a method of measuring. You think that's an incorrect statement of the law? You think that they're just not allowed?
Well, Leatham Smith indicated in the conjunctive some exceptions. And I think the court was, the Court of Appeals was just saying, regardless of those exceptions, it's generally disfavored. And Leatham Smith specifically says that income approach is never admissible when there are comparable sales available. And therefore, in this case, it's clear that there were comparable sales available. So regardless of whether it was just disfavored or whether or not it's never admissible when there are comparable sales available, in this case, there were comparable sales available, and therefore the court did not erroneously exercise its discretion, which, of course, is the major issue here, the standard of review, whether or not the court erroneously exercised its discretion in excluding the income evidence. And I don't think there's any question that the court followed the line of reasoning relating to a discretionary decision, that is, considering the facts, looking at the law, and reaching a reasonable conclusion with respect to the admissibility of the income evidence in this case.
On a couple of paragraphs above, the Court of Appeals says, in Leatham, the Supreme Court noted income evidence is ordinarily inadmissible to establish property values, so it's not reliable. Then it goes on to say in the beginning of 17, we agree the status of admissibility of income evidence is confusing in light of Leatham. And then they go on to generally disfavored. So they read Leatham in a whole variety of ways.
Chief, I have another question.
Justice Babbage.
I can let you sit down now. I want to go back to this access question one more time.
May I make one more point then before we leave income? No?
And on 13 it says the court then went on to hold and leave them that income evidence is never admissible when evidence of comparable sales is. Yes.
I did want to point out one thing about the variability of the income to the owner here. The comparable sales that were used by the owner's appraiser are of properties that had variable clauses in their rental agreements. In other words, there is some variability with respect to the income, even to the owner, based on the variable income clauses or the variable rate clauses in the rental leases. And indeed, that was true here, too.
Justice Babbitt has a question.
I want to go back to access for just
yes.
a moment. Although you say that the Court of Appeals opinion says that the existence of a frontage road as a matter of law is a reasonable access. That's what the Court of Appeals essentially said. And they cited Schneider for that. I have had the opportunity up here to read a little bit of Schneider, and I'm not sure that it says that. So let's assume for the moment that the providing of a frontage road is not ipso facto reasonable, but that the parties have an opportunity to show that the frontage road is not reasonable access. Doesn't this case then have to go back to allow National Auto to at least put in evidence that even given the existence of a frontage road, it was not reasonable?
Well, first of all, of course, I rely on my prior arguments regarding per se reasonableness of the frontage road in light of the statutes that I cited. But second of all, I do agree with plaintiff in this regard. A before and after decision, if it were determined that this was a compensable change in access, which we certainly don't agree with, then it would be a situation where the jury has two questions before it. What was the before value? What is the after value? And any diminution in value with respect to a relocation of the accesses would be taken into account by the jury in making that determination of the before value and the after value.
And it would include the whole 0.27 acreage.
Yes.
Whole thing would be
both offered. Things. Right. Both items, yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. McGee. Mr. Gunn, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
With respect to the access issue, Ms. McGee argued that she was, in fact, relying on the fact that this was part of an interstate highway project, and I believe that's one of the state's stronger arguments as to why National Auto should not be entitled to compensation. If you actually read the statutes set forth in 84.29, which was repeatedly mentioned by the state, I would respectfully direct the Court's attention to subparagraph or parenthetical paragraph 8 of that statute, which specifically says that the establishment of any portion of the interstate highway system shall not affect private property rights of access to pre-existing public highways, and any property rights taken shall be acquired in the manner provided by law. The statute goes on to say, no previously existing public highway shall be converted into a freeway or expressway without acquiring by donation, purchase, or condemnation the right of access thereto of the owners of abutting lands. We haven't donated a right of access. The state hasn't purchased it. It's a condemnation. And the very statutory scheme upon which the state is relying spells out that it's irrelevant that it's part of an interstate highway system.
But, Counsel, what bothers me here, and I'm going back and forth on this, is this sort of proposition that the establishment of a frontage road as a matter of law provides reasonable access. You obviously must take, you have a difference with that statement.
Here's where that, I believe, and respectfully, I believe here's where the confusion arises from. That holding or that suggestion has arisen in the context of controlled access highways, like Schneider. In connection with a controlled access highway, and in several other cases too, the Court has said, yes, the state can limit or restrict access up to a certain point, but if you go too far, for example, if you take all access, then it becomes a taking for which compensation has to be paid. The point was that if you provide some alternate access, and again, the cases are a little unclear, but some alternate access and probably alternate reasonable access, such as a frontage road, then the state doesn't have to pay for depriving all direct access to a controlled access highway.
But now, the trial court had the information available to it as to the before and after, and was able, presumably, if they wanted to go out there and take a look at it. Why couldn't the court simply say, as a matter of law, the access, as it exists afterwards, is reasonable? And therefore, I'm not going to allow the jury to even debate that question.
Mm-hmm. Frankly, because of this Court's previous decisions, and there have been at least three that say the question of whether or not access is reasonable is a jury question. And frankly, I don't think the trial court, you know, had enough information that he could have made a determination one way or the other as to access was reasonable. And that kind of gets back to the point I was trying to make earlier about what's reasonable for one property may not be reasonable for another one.
But what would, if you were going if we were to send this back to allow you to get some evidence in front of a jury about reasonableness, what kind of evidence would you be putting in a case like this where it's less than 3 football fields difference?
Well, as a threshold matter, it is our position that as a matter of law, because it's a partial taking and it's not a controlled access highway, we're entitled to recover for a 1% interference with access, you know, if you could envision such a thing. There's no threshold level of, you know, having to show we've been deprived of reasonable access. But if this Court determines that, no, you can't recover unless you've been deprived of reasonable access, then we would bring in experts from the travel center industry, experts from National Auto Truck Stops, appraisers who have valued these properties both with good access and without good access. I presume there would be planners who would discuss or who would testify as to how you design and lay out a truck stop and where you put them and where you don't put them because the access is so bad. We would introduce evidence, and some of this did come in, that in the before situation, this truck stop was selling, and I'm making up numbers and I apologize for that, it is in the record, but I'll get my order of magnitude correct. It was selling 1 million gallons of gas a year before the taking, and after the taking was selling 300,000 gallons of gas a year. It's a huge drop. And all those people who aren't coming there buying gas also aren't going into the convenience store, and they're not buying goods. They're not using the restaurant. I mean, it was devastating to this property. And it is our position, and I believe in my heart of hearts, we can show that this property has been deprived of reasonable access.
May I ask?
Yes.
You preface your response to Justice Bablich by saying, because there was a partial taking. Are you referring to the 0.27 acres?
Exactly.
The trial court says, hey, there's no partial taking here, because 2.7 acres is way there on the other corner, is not related at all to the issue of whether or not you have a property right in the access. And how do you respond to that? Because they separate out, the trial court separates out and says, you know, we're not dealing with that taking at all. We're just talking about whether or not there's a property right to access and whether there's any been, and whether there's been a partial taking here. Do you need this 0.27 acres in part of your analysis?
If there hadn't, the best way for me to respond to the question is to say that, is to report as best I can what the decisions of this court have been. And historically, you know, going back many years, they have consistently, every single case, bar none, said that when the state invokes what it, you know, calls the awesome power of condemnation to take private property from someone, that that is a triggering event that entitles the property owner to just compensation.
If I may, if there had been no taking of the 0.27 acres, but just a reconfiguration similar to what we have now of the right to access, would you have any legal basis to advance your argument?
We would then bear the burden of going to court in the first instance and saying that, bringing what's called an inverse condemnation case, and at that point having to prove to the court that we had been deprived of reasonable access. And if we succeeded in doing that, the state would commence the condemnation to compensate us for that loss.
This is really a regulatory taking as to the access argument rather than a physical taking.
And they took bulldozers, Your Honor, and closed up the existing access points. I have trouble saying it's a pure regulatory.
Well, I was reading Midden's article in William Mitchell Law Review that discusses Minnesota cases, but also U.S. Supreme Court. And it says, by comparison, the Supreme Court of the United States is yet to decide a case where loss of access is deemed a compensable taking. Prior to 1900, the Supreme Court had three physical taking cases regarding loss of access, but was unwilling to find the Fifth Amendment taking.
I
agree with that?
I don't agree or disagree. I would love to know what the cases were, and I'd love to be able to respond to you on them.
Well, it's in Midden, and the cases and sites are, give me a minute. Sites to another law review. Talks about these in a Columbia Law Review article, Comprehensive History of Takings Law under the Fifth Amendment. Physically taking, that's the history of the Fifth Amendment.
And it cites the three Supreme Court cases you mentioned?
No, it does not, but it cited another proceedings. Anyway, that's his view about access. Do you have cases from the United States Supreme Court that indicate it is a taking to limit access?
I can't think of a case that where the U.S. Supreme Court has decided access one way or the other, and that's all I can tell you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gunn, and thank you, Ms. McGee, for your argument on the issue of taking of access. That concludes our hearing on 02-1384, National Order Truck Stops versus Wisconsin Department of Transportation. We are in recess until 9:45 tomorrow.